Thanks very much. I just want to start by acknowledging that we're gathered here today in the traditional territories of the Coast Salish First Nations. And also acknowledge that I'm really jazzed. This is exciting. We had a tremendous opportunity this afternoon. A number of us from Vance City gathered together because a number of us were jazzed about Majora Carter coming to town. So we got a chance to spend 45 minutes or an hour sharing lunch and just hearing some of her stories and getting into a bit of a question and answer dialogue. And there was a palpable buzz in the room. And one of the things I said in leaving is, I can't wait until we do this with like a couple hundred people. Because there's a real energy that I'm sure she'll bring to the presentation here, an inspiration that I hope we take away, and I'm sure one of her takeaways will be an inspiration from what's been happening in this particular neighborhood, because I know I get a charge out of that too. And I think even just the crowd here is an indication that there's something happening in this particular neighborhood. People are sensing that we're part of something much bigger. The businesses are identifying themselves as part of this green economy and a neighborhood unto itself. A number of social enterprises are starting to bubble up. I think there's just a real recognition that this type of new economy is possible. And so for me and for Vance City, that's exactly the type of activity that we want to try and support and invest in as a local community-based financial institution. And it's really for any of you that are Vance City members, it's your money. And it's your organization, and I'm fiercely proud to be part of that. And I think it's events like this and gatherings like this that sort of represent the genesis of our organization and what we want to try to support here. So I'm not going to get into a lot of detail in terms of Majora Carter's background, other than to just let you know. Wow, most of you have probably seen the bio, and it was. One of the board chairs at Vance City Community Foundation is Heather Tremaine, a number of you may have crossed paths with here in the green building realm and has been involved in this community. Heather's off at Harvard with this very hoi polloi scholarship that she's a fellowship that she's a part of there. And they get to take any course they want at Harvard, and they also just get to meet really amazing people as part of the fellowship itself. And I remember her missing a board meeting a while ago. She usually calls in and she says, I can't come because I'm having dinner with Majora Carter. I wasn't even sure who she was, but I started to do some research and then I started to get really, really jealous. And so when the opportunity came up, we were approached by Bob at Strathcona BIA that they wanted to bring Majora Carter to them. I said, absolutely. Like, we got to be part of that. So very, very proud to be a sponsor of this particular event, and particularly proud to introduce Majora, who's going to share some of her experience in the inner city in South Bronx in terms of what I hope is an analogous process of a community coming together and really recognizing the inherent value in what you can do in building a new economy and the value of community organizing. And her list of accomplishments and kudos is far too long to list here. I know she's a genius as anointed by the MacArthur Foundation, who have lots of money, so they must be smart. And she's been recognized. A number of the recognitions are most influential this, most influential that. And I hope that she'll bring a lot of that here to the presentation. I'm really looking forward to hearing the. She said there'll be the full story tonight, so we got a snippet of it today at lunch. But she said she's got pictures and is ready to share the whole deal with us. So, without any further ado, Majora Carter.
Stand up, please. Alrighty. Now, just because it's sort of at the end of the day and there's a lot been going on, and I know you guys have had an amazing day over at the expo and with each other, but I need you to do a little something for me if you don't mind. I need a little stretch because it's late for me now. So anyway, just roll your shoulders back, everybody. Can you hear the guys in the front row might hear my back crack, actually. It's just a little nasty. Oh my God, that was my neck. Roll your neck around one direction, and then the other. Oh God, that feels good. Now turn around and face the person next to you. If it doesn't work the first time, turn the other direction. Now put your, raise your arms way up like this, wiggle them, and now put them down and give your neighbor a hug. That's just to remind you that you're all community and you are all love. Please be seated. Oh, there's even like multiple hugs going on back there. I know how it feels, believe me. And I'm not going to be upset that nobody came up to give me a hug. It's all right. I know. It's my fault because I didn't specifically ask you to. But anyway, okay, the event of this, the name of this event, Sustainability 2.0, and for those of you guys in this room, you clearly know what it is, but I swear if you look at like the signs in the media around you, you'd think that everybody was doing it. Green, sustainably, you name it, it is. But it also has the major potential, as you've probably noticed, to be something a little bit scary. You know, there's things like clean coal. A little bit of an oxymoron if there ever was one, but still, for those of us that know what those words really mean and what they really embody and should mean for the world and for the planet, for our future, then you know that we have just literally scratched the surface and there's a lot more going on. But what I'd like to talk to you about tonight is sort of how things happen, because I gotta tell you, it's like I'm from a community, and in many cases, like I'm looking out at this audience and I realize it's still shocking to me that people actually come and hear me talk. Because from where I'm from, for the most part, it was not expected of people that came from my community. You know, and I'm from the South Bronx, it's one of the poorest congressional districts in the country, in my country, and, you know, better yet, let me just show you, okay? So, when my parents actually moved to this community back in the late 1940s, tell me, is this okay, the sound, all right? Back in the late 1940s, they came up from down south, from the American South, as part of the Great American Migration, you know, of blacks that went up north looking for a better life. They moved to the Hunts Point section of the South Bronx, which was at the time a mostly white working class community. And it was a walk to work community, which meant that folks actually worked in the industrial section and lived in the residential section, and they walked between either one. Lots of folks followed suit, you know, in search of the great American dream, mostly from down south, and then later on starting from Puerto Rico and then later the Dominican Republic. White flight happened. We also experienced a huge highway construction boom in America at that time. The name Robert Moses was the person who was most responsible in our state. And he had never seen a neighborhood that, you know, that was predominantly poor and often of color that he didn't think, you know, could be raised in order to build a highway through it. This is the Cross Bronx Expressway. And I show this picture because it looks like it was just sort of like smack down in the middle of this area, and it really was. The South Bronx lost about 500,000 people because of the way the highways were created in our the spaghetti network of highways. Redlining was a term that was created around here. I think you're very familiar with it here as well. It's when banks would literally create red lines in areas where they were not going to make any kind of financial investment. And my zip code is 10474. And that's around the time I came in. But this is what happened in many, many regards. Landlords, because there was no kind of investments that people could go to actually work to support their properties, many landlords often found it more profitable to literally torch their buildings, commit arson, rather than try to and collect insurance money. Many businesses just left for greener pastures elsewhere, sometimes overseas. But this is what was left, and this is the South Bronx that I grew up in. These were the kind of pictures that I saw, I saw walking, you know, to and from school every day, but also saw on the nightly news. Like, we were definitely considered, you know, the poster child for urban blight. We were considered, there was nothing good that could come from my community. nothing. We were, if you were a pimp, a pusher, or a prostitute, and I swear these were the images that I heard every single day. You know, and I knew what I was, I knew what I wasn't. But this is not what we were told by the media at all. Not to say that we weren't without our problems. We, believe me, we were. Huge amounts of disinvestment. I mean, there were literally moments when, you know, pieces of playgrounds were removed, and music programs in school, things like that, simply because there wasn't, you know, funds to take care of them. But so these were our playgrounds, but in many cases, we did. There was, you know, poverty breeds a lot of stuff. It really does when there's access to very limited amounts of choices. And in many cases, it was a bit of a war zone. My brother was, actually served two separate tours in Vietnam, came home, and he was shot down in a drug war the neighborhood over from mine. But all of that disinvestment kind of set the stage for all of the environmental injustices that were to come. You know, all those manufacturing facilities that actually supported, you know, huge swaths of my community that were left vacant literally became home to many of the polluting facilities that you see here right now. And we didn't ask for any of these things to come, but a poor community is often the place where it seems very politically expedient to make these kind of things happen. So the kind of environmentalism that I do is called environmental justice, and it simply means that no community should have to bear the brunt of lots of environmental burdens and not enjoy some environmental benefits. And, you know, your basic human thinking, you know, would tell you that that's normal. Right? Basic human right. But unfortunately, we know that, you know, in the States and around the world, race and class will tell you exactly where you find the good stuff, like parks and trees, and where you find the not so good stuff, like these kind of things that you find in urban areas. You know, and it's sort of like we're creating all sorts of problems, you know, from the get-go. All of these things were fossil fuel-based. You know, we just discovered a couple years ago, Columbia University did a study that showed that proximity to fossil fuel emission sources actually causes learning disabilities in young children. Conclusive evidence, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You know, so it's kind of like, why are we setting this child up to fail? When we know that kids that go to poor schools, you know, are chances are in poor communities. And that's more of a pathway to prison than it is to, say, higher education. But it is that pollution, you know, whether if we're on the extraction or the consumption end, that creates the kind of problems that separate us in so, so many ways. It's the pollution-based economy that's really determined by the way that we live, you know, the way that the structures of this world, based on oil and coal for the most part. And, you know, and it's, oh, I don't know what just happened. I didn't go. Sorry, cut a little slide out. But, you know, this was often the lay of the land, but the pollution-based economy literally has separated us in so, so many ways that it literally doesn't allow us, especially if we're living in urban areas, or sometimes even if we're living in very natural ones like this, to think of the fact that we are really separate. Because there used to be a time when people would live, you know, near the people that made the stuff that they would buy, and it was, you know, food was grown nearby. Now we kind of need things like petroleum-based fertilization in order to create, you know, the kind of food that grows. And sometimes it's 2,000 miles away from your plate, you know, and things of that nature. So we're trying to think about ways, like, how do we recognize and remember that we're part of one ecosystem as well. So this, I just want to show you this piece because, you know, whether it's in an urban area or someplace like this, these are the mountains of West Virginia. And this is what coal mining, mountaintop removal coal mining actually looks like. You know, just to show you the sense of scale, these earth mover trucks, the little diagonal line on that truck is actually a full story high. It's when they chop off the top of a mountain and then dig coal out from underneath it. And, you know, I went there to visit a dear friend of mine who's actually one of the one of my country's premier anti-mountaintop removal activists, named Judy Bonds. And this was her family's homeland, with eight generations of her family there. You know, one of the most diverse ecosystems is actually in the Appalachian Mountains in southeastern and the middle part of America, and just being destroyed systematically day by day. And you know, here we are, you know, two very, very different people. You know, I'm from the inner city, and she's like, basically, you know, as they call themselves, hillbillies. We shouldn't even be talking, but we are, because we recognize that the same kind of thing, so whether it's, you know, coal that's you know, on the extraction end that's causing some serious problems there, you know, this is literally what water from downstream of a coal mine looks like. Or if it's, you know, asthma in our cities, or obesity and diabetes that we're experiencing as well. I mean, we're experiencing an epidemic of type 2 diabetes in kids as young as 3 years old. This used to be the kind of disease that nobody got before they were like 35, 40, and that was only in the worst cases of health. But see, if me and Judy Bonds could realize that we could be working together, anybody can. Because the same environmental injustice that actually does tie us together, you know, and who says that, you know, poor whites and poor blacks and everybody in between weren't supposed to be talking, but we are. And that's a really powerful place to be. But again, the same environmental injustice that ties us together, the environmental justice that we can produce from all sorts of ways is going to tie us together as well. So one of the things that how I got my start in this literally was actually moving back home and coming to terms with the fact that my community was nothing that I thought it was. I really did hate it. I thought that it was the worst place that a human being could grow up in, and that the last place I wanted to be was there. Fortunately, you know, the gods of the universe decided to bring me back home and show me that it wasn't, that communities don't just make, the people in them are sometimes not the people that make a community what it is. There are often very deliberate forces from outside. Ours came in the form of our mayor, Mayor Giuliani, and our governor, Pataki, who decided that they needed to build a huge waste facility on our waterfront that would have brought more than 40% of the city's commercial waste to it, municipal waste to our community. We were already handling 40% of the city's commercial. And so it seemed like you could just say that, do that, you know what we're handling. Why would you do that unless you thought there was something wrong with us? And it really did politicize me and realize that this is just, I wanted to be a part of a different kind of solution that included me and my community. And so we worked really hard to help create you know, a more sustainable solid waste management plan and advocate for that. But the real reason why I'm in this work is this dog, truly. You know, same time we were fighting the waste facility, I kept getting these notices from this group that was like, look, we have these little seed grants to give you, because we hear you're a community activist and we like community activists, and you got a river, do something on it. And I was like, you can't get to the river from here. You can't. It's just like, if there's industry, there's this, there's that, you don't want to go down there. But fortunately, I got this 80-pound dog. I'm not sure what that translates to in kilos. But anyway, she's a big girl. Huh? 40? 40, thank you very much. Bless your heart, have the mouths of babes, I love it. And I should have known that, but you know. Anyway, my 40 kilo dog took me jogging and into this really disgusting dump and pulled me into this thing. And I swear, I've never been in this place before in my life. And this is, it turns out that like there was tons of construction and demolition debris, like literally over my head. And piles of tires and weeds that you almost needed a machete, but I have my 40 kilo dog. And she pulled me into this dump. But the beautiful thing was that dump actually dead ended at the Bronx River. And if you stood right there and didn't look back at the crap behind you, and it was 6:30 in the morning and the sunlight was glinting off the water, and I was just like transported to this magical place. And then I realized, this magical place is my neighborhood. Oh my gosh. So I went back up and wrote the proposal. And after I did that, that was the magical part. Went, you know, many, many different community cleanups, and even worked and partnered with the city to help create what is this right now. And this was it after about a $3 million grant and major just love and support from folks in the neighborhood who now use it, and it's only been in this form for the past couple of years, and I really loved it so much I got married there a couple years ago, and noticed my flower girl. Yeah, that's my baby. But what this thing did was not just, you know, create an awesome space for me and my wedding, but it, I actually had some like crazy person say, oh, you just did that because you wanted to get married there. I was like, when I first started doing this work, the last thing I thought was anybody was gonna marry me for the love of God. It was just like, I was so into my job, I couldn't have cared less. But anyway, but it was a beautiful place, and it is, and I hope there'll be many, many more marriages there. However, the interesting thing is that it really, even in its different incarnations, it really helped the community to think about what else we could have in our community. It wasn't just like, just because, you know, our mayors and other folks and regulators thought that we only deserve garbage, we started to realize that we deserve more. And it was that kind of empowering, you know, place that we grew from. And I know I personally grew from it when I saw the response of people around me. And so I actually used it as an opportunity to think about what else we could do. And I actually wrote a $1.25 million proposal, a federal transportation proposal, to design and plan the South Bronx Greenway, which is a linear park, you know, that connects with the waterfront, parks on the waterfront, but it's dedicated waterfront esplanades and also on-street bike paths. And it just makes this like really beautiful way for people to get around. And it's also, you know, for recreation, but also, you know, for stormwater management techniques as well, because anything there actually attracts and retains stormwater as well. So this street actually leads directly down into the park. And this is what it's gonna look like as we start spending about $20 million worth of funding, you know, on that. And this itself, you know, it is a linear park, you know, what we're trying to build, because it's 11 miles. And the whole idea is that, you know, the South Bronx, especially because of the highways, was so disconnected from the rest of the city. There's actually something called the East Coast Greenway in the States that goes all the way from Maine down to Miami. It completely bypassed the South Bronx. So this actually puts us in the rest of New York City as it gets built. And so this is what it's going to look like as we create this little piece that's going to connect us to another 400-acre park called Randall's Island. So this is a way to get us to like the bigger parks, because remember, ours is a little skinny. But the thing that it was most, the thing that I'm still the most proud about, and I'm proud about everything that I did at Sustainable South Bronx, but the most proud moments of my life were when we recognized that as we were struggling to really help restore the environment in our community, that we needed to make sure that we included people in that too. And so we started a program called BEST, which stands for Bronx Environmental Stewardship Training, and we trained folks, you know, in the skills of ecological restoration. And we started on the waterfront because we realized as we started doing that work on the river to build parks that they weren't hiring locally. And it was just like, we got a 25% unemployment rate. Could get the brothers and sisters some jobs over here? And and so we had to figure out ways to get them employed, which meant we had to train them. And so we went through a couple of different rounds, and I think we got incredibly good at it. But later on, we were able to change what these guys are doing here is waterfront restoration. But then we were able to expand the program into urban forestry management, into green roof installation, learning how to clean up contaminated land safely, and you know, just really helping folks understand that this kind of job, of which we were, you know, most of the folks in our communities, I think, living on the planet now, are actually not too far away from being connected to the land itself. And this kind of work that they were doing, in particular around horticulture, was just one of the most therapeutic things that anybody could do. Because, you know, horticultural therapy in particular, it's actually used very cost effectively to help people go, you know, go through trauma. You know, oh, you okay? That's okay. I'm more worried about you, sweetie. That's a hard floor. you know, trauma, prisons. So you want folks doing this kind of work. And many of the folks that went through our program were, you know, they were formerly incarcerated. Many also were in the social welfare system for so long, there's decades of generational poverty. And so many of them actually had never had a family member with a job. And so they didn't have the experience of seeing that. And so giving folks those life skills, those job readiness skills, like, doing things like making sure that they showed up at work on time and being very present, leadership skills, team building, those were just as important. And because of both the combination of hard skills and soft skills and really creating a really nurturing environment for people to feel that they were a part of something bigger, actually helped us get one of the highest job training and placement rates of anybody that I know, you know, in my country at 85%. I mean, that's about as good as you're gonna get. And, you know, considering the type of folks that we were working with, it was even more extraordinary. But I think it was extraordinary because all we recognized was that we valued people. We valued them for what they were going to contribute, not the drama and the trauma that was in their lives before. All we did was help them understand that the power, the same power that they had, you know, in their lives to make bad decisions were, because we gave them a choice, was going to allow them to make good ones. And so they start to recognize that, you know, they weren't just putting money in their pockets, which is an important thing to do. I mean, that builds self-respect and all sorts of groovy things like that. But to really understand that your work is actually making the world a better place, now that's real power. And these guys have it. I was really excited that we were able to hire some of the folks because, again, the Greenway was coming, but my community had some of the lowest parks per person ratios in any place else in the country. So we had to kind of, we sort of needed ambassadors of the Greenway. We needed to, like, help. There was an education process that we had to take folks through our community through and help them understand why trees were really important, why urban horticulture and urban forestry was an important thing to have in their communities. And so what this young man looks like, he's all he's doing is just pruning a tree. Actually, pruning a tree is not that simple. You have to know how to do it to make it live and all that groovy stuff. But what he's also doing is being a social scientist. He spoke to people that lived on this block and found out that underneath this tree, because the street light that's across the street from here, because the tree branches were hanging so low, there was a lot of illegal activity happening underneath that tree. So in speaking to folks, he realized if he just cut some of those lower hanging branches down, which also helped the tree, but it also made the light come through, then guess what? The crime rate in that area dropped. Crime prevention through environmental design. Very, very, very effective and inexpensive. So when you're talking about, like, what else do you need to tell your city, these are the kind of things that actually pay off in dividends. Another thing that they did was, again, thinking about, we're building community here. That hug that I asked you to do is about that. I hope some of you did hug strangers and got to know them soon. But what he did here, this particular tree is in front of a senior citizen center in the neighborhood. So, you know, as we get older, you know, we tend to suffer, often get a sense of social isolation, you know, as senior citizens. And what people wanted to do here was make sure that people had felt like they could come out more and be a part of community, because that's also a crime prevention technique called eyes on the street. So just having that opportunity for people to be there was also really, really smart. Oh, and we got $3 million to build a park. We did not get any money to actually do any marketing around it. So we had to use some fairly guerrilla techniques. Like painting a green line down the street as a trailblazing project, and with giving it no real explanation. People just had to follow it. And they did, because that's like part of human psychology. If you see a path, you will follow it. It's really kind of funny, but it totally works. And the kids even made up little songs about it. I actually watched them, but it was really very sweet. The green line takes you to the park. I know, because I followed it. That was very cute. And we had extra paint, so we did a clean up after your dog poop campaign. Always good to redo this a lot, I've noticed, because it takes some time. But we also wanted to show that this sustainability thing wasn't just a good idea because it made you feel good. It also could make you some money. And so we did a business, we started the development of we started our own single purpose subsidiary called Smart Roofs, and it's a green roof installation business. And so we were able to do this because we love the idea. I know you've got plenty of green roofs here in Vancouver, but the idea that this is a sustainable building technique, that it attracts stormwater, that it actually, you know, helps mitigate urban heat island, which we know we need to do a lot more of now as global warming is right on our heels. It also, you know, it keeps your roof lasting a whole lot longer because, you know, now that a roof basically is just, you know, when it breaks, it's basically just sun damage. That's, you know, that contraction and expansion of a roof under sunlight. So you cover your roof, and guess what, it lasts long. I think the oldest roofs in Germany are about 60 years old now. And it's a cooling layer as well. And they also, I said sunscreen. Gosh, you guys are like, hello, who's doing the presentation here? I'm like, not that I mind at all, but this was the roof we did mostly with just some seedlings and cuttings on my roof back, I think, a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, and this is what it looks like. This is what it looked like last year. Then now it's going to look even hotter. But we also wanted to show that there are different types of green roofs you can do. You know, some requiring a lot more maintenance than others. The one that I did on my roof with little sedums doesn't really require much of anything. Although we do maintain it at least once a month just until it starts to grow in. But these crazy grasses, there's also opportunities for some serious urban agriculture on top of your roofs as well. You know, we did this little demonstration planting just to show that you can do this stuff, and it was really a little gross after a while because I wouldn't let anybody eat them because we had to show them off to people that came to our roof. I would, however, let them eat the strawberries because that would have just been far too mean of me. We did compost the other stuff as well, but these were the most incredible strawberries we've ever had. And you know, we want to see more of these things, not just because they're beautiful, which they are, but they also, you know, help deal with a really serious stormwater management issue that all cities have. You know, so many of us have combined sewage outfalls, which means that water from your sewage, you know, from your toilets and your sinks, they all get funneled together, you know, with water that falls from the sky, hits your rooftops, and goes down storm drains. That water does not need to be processed the same way that your sewage does. But unfortunately, these kind of single-use and very ugly plants are often how it's all done. But just imagine, you know, if we actually looked at the fact that those kind of beautiful green jobs in particular that are created by doing this kind of large-scale development, the cost savings, you know, so you're not taxing, you know, or not taxing as much these kind of systems. And just also think about the fact that you have great opportunities, you know, for birds to fly south for the winter and get a nice little rest, which would be really kind of pretty. And the fact that, you know, pretty much any urban area, 20% of an urban area's roof, of their surface area, are rooftops. So you've got a tremendous opportunity there to cool your city down, you know, especially in these times. And the kind of cost savings, you know, to your sewage treatment system are also, I just want to make sure that that's a really important thing to talk about as well. Let's see, where am I? Oh, and yes, I love the green stuff, as you can probably tell, but I also look at technology. I think horticultural infrastructure actually is a technology as well, but I look at the kind of horticultural, I look at this kind of stuff as also just as important. We partnered with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology on a project called Fabrication Laboratories, or Fab Labs for short, and basically all it is, you know, some, you know, regular old computers coupled with some fabrication machines, so everything from milling machines to, you know, laser jet cutters and things of that nature. And once you know the design software, and it's all always open source, as far as I know, it's usually open source. Once you know that, you can pretty much create almost anything you want. Like, I first found out about it when folks in Ghana with a mobile Fab Lab unit were actually creating little solar power generators for their community that had no access to being on the grid. And so they were able to like have a little more light, create cottage industries around it. It was a really awesome thing to do. And so what we wanted to do it as a way to give folks in our community an opportunity to not only just cross the digital divide, but also to become inventors and creators, you know, in their own right as well. And we also wanted to have some fun with the idea of what could be different. You know, our community really is a repository for a lot of things that end up in somebody else's landfill. Even the recycled goods often end up that way as well. And we had some real serious issues with that. Fortunately, some of the groovy fab fellows, you know, at the Fab Lab recognized that, you know, oh, we're also home to, like, I think the world's largest food distribution center. enormous. Like 70% of New York City's regions, you know, produce comes from within six blocks of my house. It's transshipped in, trucked in and out. 40% of its meats and about 100% of its fish. And, you know, unfortunately, we live in a food desert, which means it doesn't stay in that community, but lots of other places around get the kind of food that we deal with the diesel traffic on. But anyway, some of these guys discovered that the pallet boxes that these things come in on were actually made of some pretty nice wood. And they realized that if you lash it together, you can actually create stuff like a pretty nice, interesting furniture line. And so this group actually is interested in like working with some, they've become small manufacturers in their own right. And right now it's in a NASCAR trailer, the whole operation. And Sustainable South Bronx is actually looking for a space, you know, somewhere else as well. Now, pop quiz for you. Most people on the planet now know that USA, 5% of the world's population, and we produce 25% of its what? Definitely. Greenhouse gases, round that with waste as well. Most people don't know that. Unless, of course, you're at the London School of Economics, which did that study and showed that 25% of the world's population that's on parole, on probation, or in jail or prison is actually in the land of the free. Yeah, it's a pretty shameful kind of thing. So you remember this adorable little child and the promise and possibility that he could represent. And, you know, and that he's probably got a better chance of going here than to higher education because of the kind of pathways to poverty and also being in close proximity to pollution actually create. You know, and most folks definitely also know that, you know, the rate at which we're still building things like coal-burning power plants, you know, comes at a super, super high cost to the world's, you know, in global environment, of course. But we often don't necessarily think about the fact that they're actually connected and that destroying, you know, the manufacturing base, you know, so many places, you know, has done not just, you know, and shipping it overseas, where it's also not really helping the folks there either, in so many ways, environmentally and otherwise. But most people don't necessarily take the leap and think about what it's done, you know, to help destroy the fabric, you know, in communities around the world. And, you know, and how people often supported whole families on that. And I was really struck by a gentleman on the panel earlier who said the line that once industry goes, it doesn't just come back. It's true. And so seeing and watch, you know, under feeling the impacts and seeing what it has, the effects that it has on everything, on the economic stability, you know, not just, it's because you just can't do this in GDP, because the GDP, you know, of any country doesn't necessarily make a difference between whether or not you're building prison cells or whether you're building factories that employ people. And that is the problem. And that's why sustainability is so important for everybody to really understand, like, not that it's some pie in the sky kind of tree hugging kind of thing, but it's a difference between your city, you know, your community, your family, your country, and your world being a place that supports people and has dignity, or it being something where these kind of things are important and is what makes your world go round. Not the kind of world I think any of us want to live in. But to that end, you know, we're constantly looking for ways to think about what else can we do. And that little green spot on that piece of, on that, my Hunts Point, little thing that looks like a turtle head, that's my neighborhood. And Oak Point is this really interesting site that has, like, old barge and rail access, which really spoke to my community's former industrial, you know, heritage. And so we actually found, you know, I'm not sure if we describe eco-industrial park the same way that you guys do, but the way that we described it is that it's a collection of businesses that just use recycled materials as raw materials. And so we looked at that site, and it had more than 20-some acres And I don't know what that means in terms of hectares. I'm sorry, I can never remember that. But the place has like barge and rail access, so you're taking trucks off the road. We would totally be able to design it, you know, so that the Greenway could go through it. We found businesses that were willing to locate in this community, and we were so excited about the possibility of, you know, the recycled goods that often end up as somebody else's problem in somebody else's landfill actually becoming value-added raw materials, you know, for the kind of products that people actually would pay to buy. And so we were very excited about this, and we're just like, this is a perfect example of what communities could and should be doing, you know, in support of, you know, not just, you know, our local community, because of course we were. I mean, look at our unemployment, you know, poverty rates. Of course we're concerned about our community, but we also knew that we would be helping to deal with a really serious and a very expensive solid waste management problem in our city as well. And so we thought this would be a really perfect thing for us to be doing together, and we're very excited about the contribution that we were going to be making, you know, to our city and to, you know, to our community. But unfortunately, at the same time that we had this great idea, turns out that my city had decided that that same piece of land was going to be perfect for a 2,000-bed jail. And it was a very, very difficult time in the history of, you know, me personally and my community as a whole. The city has since decided to abandon plans for the jail on that site. But they've not, just on that site, they haven't totally abandoned plans yet. We've got a lot of education to do on them, especially since they are actually trying to like win the world's, you know, title as the most sustainable city, you know, in the world, which is funny because, you know, and I have asked this question publicly. So are you guys planning on using those 2,000 beds as part of your affordable, sustainable housing strategy? They haven't answered. But, you know, still thinking about, there's still, you know, the jury is, we're not done with that fight, and I will keep you posted, and hopefully, prayerfully, we'll actually have, people will come to their senses and realize that you give people choices that they will make the right one. And the kind of environmental services that the folks that we were trying to, you know, give training to would actually help our city make a, you know, save money and lower their own, you know, public health costs and all those other costs, you know, incarceration costs, in particular prison recidivism, and actually provide a more stable supply of tax-paying individuals. That's how you deal with a recession. Yeah. But another really beautiful thing, and this works for my country, I'm not quite sure how it works for, you know, here, although I am absolutely sure that somewhere along the line, it's always sunny or windy someplace in this country. But it may not be the places where you have one, where the power actually is. So what we're really proposing, you know, in our, or some of us anyway, are proposing is the creation of the national grid. And so just like, you know, when the U.S. Department of Defense built the internet to spy on Russia, that laid the groundwork for all the internet businesses that were to come. You know, they didn't need all sorts of incentives. Like, you just had really smart people that understood that this was a really awesome way to make some money. And they did it. A lot of it. And still are. You know, it's like the lady, you know, who has a place up in, you know, Washington State, you know, selling tchotchkes, you know, out of her, like, you know, single, you know, resident occupancy, you know, room. She can sell those to, like, anybody, you know, on the other side of the state, based because she can do it in her home. The same kind of thing with the national grid. I'm really hoping that we could actually use the U.S. highways right-of-ways, which would be so cool. That way we wouldn't have to go through any, like, you know, protected wilderness or anything like that. And they're there already, but that's another thing we're not quite clear about actually happening either. But the idea that this kind of federally owned infrastructure, which means it would be owned by us, would allow for the renewable energy that we know needs to get from one place to another. Otherwise, coal will always be king, you know, and oil will always be his queen. But going through, you know, all the work that we've done in the South Bronx really did help me realize that the South Bronx Well, I love it, and I always will, but there are many South Bronxes, you know, in urban and rural, even in suburban areas. And I knew that the kind of work that we were doing there was replicable in other places. And so I actually left Sustainable South Bronx last year to start my own green economic development consulting firm, because our goal was to really, the same way that even when we were fighting with the city, we still worked with the city and did some beautiful things with them. We helped them understand that when they saw us as valuable, then their value rose as well. You know, and I don't care what their reasons were for working with us. I really don't. All I know is that we all got something beautiful out of it. And just imagine if we all lived in a world that everybody valued everybody else. You know, if we'd built, you know, waste facilities and power plants and sour gas mines, all that tar sands, you know, in wealthy communities as quickly, you know, as we did in poor ones. This economy would have been clean and green a long time ago.
Yeah.
But since we didn't, and we are in the middle of this economic crisis and environmental crisis, then we can recognize that we can use the same tools to alleviate poverty and remediate the environment. The kind of green job training and placement that I'm talking about that actually needs to involve, you know, folks from the public and the private sector, the university sector, community groups, business leaders, you name it, needs to involve them all so that they can see how their individual self-interest, how those needs will be met by supporting others. Because tell me what you think it'll be like if, you know, young man, woman, you know, who's been over living over here, you know, I'm just talking about the marginal ones. I'm not necessarily the ones who, you know, have the mental illness and stuff like that, but the folks who just kind of need a little bit of support, that if they had the opportunity to go to a job training program in the green collar field, got that job, was able to stay off the street, became a tax-paying citizen, just think of the stability in that family, how that would peter down to their children. How they suddenly do not become the kind of drain that they were, because social services that were often spent on those families isn't paid anymore. Yeah. And that people understand that they have a sense of purpose, that their life is as good as anybody else's because they know that they're contributing to the life of a city. That is their city, that they feel invested in. That's the kind of city that we all want to be in. And that's what the green economy can actually help us do. And I just think so much, and you know, this is what I do, you know. I think about the kind of place that, you know, say someone, you know, wants to be in. I think about, you know, so much about the fact that we've got an opportunity to built to really to say, you know what, we are not going to do the pollution-based economy anymore. Why? Because we can't really afford to, and mostly because we don't really want to. Because there's something greener and more beautiful out there. Because I think a lot, you know, I think about the civil rights movement a lot. You know, I do. I think about women's suffrage a lot. I think about the fact that we've not, you know, that those were movements that came out of like a hope and aspiration of something really, really huge that many people didn't even think would happen in their lifetime. But I've seen how this has changed people's lifetimes, you know, in the here and now. You know, I know that if we work really hard and work together on this, then everybody, and I do mean everybody, wins, because the future really isn't about black or white or red or brown or anything like that. The future is green. And we've got to recognize that. Thank you very much. Okay. Okay, you.
Well,
Marco, you were mentioning that you've now sort of moved on to create a consulting group, and I'm just wondering, we're hearing all kinds of news about Detroit, for instance, and what's been happening there. Can you give some examples of some of the work that you're now working on?
Repeat the question. It was examples of what we're working on now with the new consulting firm. I can't wait till we're working in Detroit, but we're not there yet. My first job, which we just got, because I just started the company back in December, we just signed a pretty big contract with in northeastern North Carolina with our client is Elizabeth City State University. And I'm sure there are a bunch of climate heads out there, but that area falls right behind the Mississippi Delta and the Florida Everglades as the area in the United States is going to be most impacted by sea level rise. And this is a very rural area, predominantly poor over there. There's some major pockets of welfare, but for the most part, their economy is actually more tied up in the hog farming industry, which has all sorts of environmental justice issues associated with it. And it's not the way that these folks want to continue on in the 21st century. So we're helping them actually create a real green inventory of what the possibilities are there. And our real job is to help them figure out, based on the future climate trends that we see going on, what are going to be the best kind of industries that can locate in that area. And so, because what our real job is to help them figure out what is the workforce of the future that they're going to need for this area to be the kind of place that people want to be in. And so that we're working with a whole bunch. We were hired by the university, but we've got connections with the 21 county region, with a whole bunch of the mayors in that area, a huge portion of the community development corporations or CDCs, and that did many, many different foundations. And so they're trying to figure out ways to work together so that we can actually figure out how do you use where they are right now as a cost-saving measure, because they know they're going to be spending the money on something, and they'd rather really think about it in terms of how do they become real players in the climate adaptation strategy industry, which is so nascent right now. You would think people would be running out trying to do this. They're not. And unfortunately, it's going to be unfortunate. So I'm glad that there are some folks actually thinking about it, proactively. Yes?
I was just wondering if, in the beginning, did you have any pushback from the community? Like, is it hard to convince people that there was really power in this concept of breeding the ghetto? And if there was, what did you do to combat that?
I came to this work really late. I mean, my community actually was definitely had, some much of its activist roots, but we were not, in many cases, very proactive about what we wanted. Like, we knew what we didn't want. So, when I would say, to people, oh, we're gonna build a park on the waterfront, what do you think about that? And I did hold meetings, and people were just like, we've got other things to worry about. And that was true. It wasn't like we didn't, but, I took the fact that many of them just didn't wanna, they didn't wanna help. I didn't take that personally. I was just like, we'll just wait and see. And if I fail, I fail. And if I don't, I don't. But I always had people working with me, but never like, until later on, it was never like huge numbers. It doesn't, and I don't think it has to be. And I think, people, recognizing that they're in this together and that you've got enough to watch your back, that's all you need. But a really funny story was when I did hold this community meeting, and there was this one very powerful group, education advocacy group in the neighborhood, and I just remember feeling the sneers, from the women in particular, who were just like, they were all mothers, and they were like saying things like, well, you don't have any kids, so you wouldn't know what it's like to send your kids through an industrial section, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, well, you gotta start somewhere. I mean, it's like, you gotta sink your claws in, and then, we'll deal with other stuff, going down, but, start. And they just ignored me after that, which was fine. But then the first time we opened that park, and I didn't even see most, because there were so many people, I didn't even see some of my particular detractors. And then later on, I saw them in the neighborhood, and they were like, oh, Majora, you did it! And I was like, no, we did it.
Yeah.
Right on. You got it. It's like, no, they say, see, now your kids can go to the park. It was hilarious. Yes.
You mentioned you got
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So was then, were you able to then persuade governments or
the $3 million was from the city.
Was from the city.
Oh yeah.
So they did come through for you.
Oh, eventually, yeah. Eventually. Oh, that was actually another federal program. Actually, it's really funny that I got my start like during the Bush administration. And I don't understand, because there were always good people working there, so you gotta understand that. I hope you do. And they did stuff under the radar screen, but they had these tiny little $10,000 seed grant programs, and they would like practically lie about where the money went in a lot of ways, because they just had to cover it up, and we learned how to cover it up ourselves. And you know, yes, we used the money for, we would use it for murals and stuff, projects like that, and then we'd have to say that we did a teaching education workshop. I mean, it was just stupid, the things that we had to do, but you know what? Done. Yeah, exactly. So you will always have friends. Yes. You know, it's not my super area of expertise. I mean, I personally think that if you build projects like the National Grid, then in that case, the market will come up. You know, people will figure out ways. I mean, I don't think, from my understanding, I don't think we're anywhere near, you know, close to getting a price on carbon that's actually going to be meaningful, you know, to folks just yet. So that's just the word on the street. Like, I don't see it happening. So that's why I'm like, can we do something, you know, that's actually going to have an impact, like, sooner than that? Yes?
If you were in the audience with city councilors and a mayor of any respective city, what would be the five things you would tell them that they can act upon?
Six things. Well, the things that I told your mayor today was think, you know, holistically, you know, about the fact that, you know, you are a city, you know, that has some issues, and that there's always money. The question is priorities. How are you prioritizing spending of those funds? Like, give you an example. You know, in New York City, there was a, you know, this literally the same week that our city decided to like literally almost tip the scales at over $1 billion to give to the New York Yankees, as major league sports team, to rebuild their stadium. They announced that they were gonna be laying off like 13 or 15,000 teachers. And it was just like, world's richest sports team, our children. There is always money. You know, and then the mayor decided he was going to run for another term, and then he opened up some campaign offices, and then decided that he wasn't going to make those cuts. There is always money. You know, the question is, are we really going to be really in folks' face enough? And I think your mayor actually kind of wants you to do that. I mean, that was just my feeling, that he just needed some support and really, you know, a push in the right direction, because it was like, look, you make the investments now in people, in green job training, you know, and helping to support local businesses that are really working, despite the lack of incentives to do that now, from my understanding. Would you say that's correct, Toby? That there's like, I'm trying to like give you like a major shout out over here, go ahead. I'm going back home in a day or so, but you know, look, I just want to be useful, and sometimes no one gives me that opportunity. But the fact that there are great green small businesses here, and they're not getting the kind of support from the city, that's a problem. These folks should be encouraged to expand, to train more people, to employ more people. And that's what's really going to help, especially when you're looking at the kind of new green businesses that actually have environmental services applied to them. So whether you're cleaning up contaminated land or doing more urban infrastructure, you know, those are the kind of things that are really, really important. And that the city, you know, if they're building community that way, then they're going to be doing a tremendous service to its own bottom line. Oh, yes.
Yeah, I was actually just wondering if you were aware that our provincial government is in the process of building a waterfront freeway right at this time, and they just demolished the last house in a neighborhood called Bridgeview. That's cutting off a very low-income neighborhood from the river, and they've got a beautiful beach down there that the neighbors want to make into a community park.
They're building a freeway on the water?
On the Fraser River. I don't know whether you've got nice sand beaches, but they've got beautiful sand beaches on the way to an industrial waste.
I'm sorry. Well, that's really troubling. Is that that's the provincial government?
Yeah.
Which community?
Surrey. Brickview, North Surrey.
Say what? That goes right over it. So, but it essentially has the same kind of, you know, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, well, okay. Where are it? Is it done? They just demolished the houses?
Yeah, they just demolished the houses before they signed the contract for the construction.
I think it's time to raise a little hell.
Basically. I'm sorry, I'm just a little...
I know.
I apologize. I'm sorry. And did it happen really quickly?
Oh, yeah.
Can I just say that there's an amazing group of people in Surrey that have rallied behind Gateway?
Yeah.
They're the warriors of Surrey. And if you reach out to them and support them in any way,
yeah.
Then they can use that.
And stop Gateway?
GatewaySucks.org. GatewaySucks.org.
What kind of community is Gateway? Is it the support community? Say what? Okay. But what kind of community did it? Was it a poor community, I take it? Yeah. But this is a, you know, so folks really didn't know about it before. I mean, so the local community was fighting, but folks outside of it that didn't necessarily know. Yeah. I mean, it often happens that way. I mean, that's, you know, when our communities are that disconnected, you know, when there is a divide between, you know, the poor communities, you know, and the more well-to-do ones. But, you know, ultimately everybody suffers. Everybody suffers when this kind of stuff happens, one way or another. You know, it'll be through increased social services. I mean, what happened to the people whose homes were demolished? You know? Just, you know, not just physically, but spiritually and emotionally. You know, that's... Yes.
What we've been hearing is that the people haven't connected the fact that this is a freeway scale bridge being built at a part of our suburban communities that will ultimately could lead to the connection of the freeway to Vancouver itself. Because we fought off the freeway.
Right. Freeways.
Yeah,
you know, I just, who are these people? I mean, do they get out much? No, they really don't. They truly don't. Yeah, like the big highway, or I don't even include it in my presentation, but there is a mile and a quarter highway called the Sheridan Expressway in our community that literally doesn't go anywhere. Literally, because at the end of Robert Moses' Reign of Terror, he wanted to build it all the way up through, like, two incredible cultural institutions in the Bronx, the Bronx Zoo and the New York Botanical Gardens, and they were more powerful than he was at the time. So guess what? The freeway just stops, doesn't go anywhere. And so the State Department of Transportation had this brilliant idea to build an 8-lane, you know, thoroughfare over what was becoming another waterfront park in our community. And we only found out about it because, you know, at a meeting kind of like this that wasn't about that, there was a transportation watchdog group there that told us, like, are you aware, you know, of what's happening, you know, with the Sheraton Expressway, how it's going to impact the work that you're doing. And we did not know. We had no clue. And, you know, and honestly, had that not happened, we would have just, I can't even imagine what our river would have looked like by now, because they just would have ripped stuff up just like that. But we created a huge alliance and even worked together with one of our elected officials that was not afraid to speak truth to power and made sure that our desire to actually see that highway torn down was at least studied in the environmental impact statement. And so it hasn't even happened just yet, but it has to be looked at. And so looking at it, you know, through the eyes of, is this thing really important? And knowing that they've got to study it that way. And so I don't know if it's too late, you know, to do something like that around this, you know, but if they haven't started building it yet, then you never know. I mean, I just think, it, especially as a collective action, you know, around the city, I mean, this could be the kind of thing that really could really galvanize like different sectors of the city. Because it will affect everybody here, from my very, you know, very cursory knowledge of Vancouver's geography. So, yowza, so way in the back. Well, I know that the goal that the BIA wants to play is playing, you know, thus far really is a convener to sort of try to bring folks together. So that's really important. But there's nothing, you know, keeping folks from actually talking to each other. And I think those organic relationships where you, you know, recognize that folks that are different from you, that live in different communities, you know, are your brothers and sisters, is a truly important thing to do. So I'm absolutely encouraging even more of that as well. Yeah, speak up louder, because now I can hear.
right, so just quickly here before we wind things down, we're going to have some final closing comments from Andrea Reimer. And I'll just do a quick introduction here of Andrea. She was elected to the Vancouver City Council in 2008, and she had previously served as a Vancouver School Board trustee from 2002 to 2005. She was also the first to be elected to Canada under the Green Party banner. She's a longtime supporter of sustainability and community economic development. She has volunteered with many community organizations, including serving as past president of the Community Congress for Economic Change Credit Union and the Canadian Women's Voters Congress, vice chair of the Local Farmers Market Society, and a former co-chair of the City of Vancouver's Food Policy Council. She currently serves as director of Toxic Free Canada and Environmental Education Action Project and sits on the Vancouver Foundation's Health and Social Development Advisory Committee. Andrea is also the executive director of the Wilderness Committee, position she's held since 2002. So I think we're lucky to have her here tonight, and we're lucky that we have her working to make our community a better place. So Andrea Reimer.
Okay, so first things first, Ben, there's a Gateway Rally coming up on...
There's one on April the 11th and another one on the 26th.
Okay, so if you go to gatewaysucks.org, you will find everything you need to know about what doesn't work about the freeway project. So I am actually here today in none of those roles you just heard about. I'm actually here today on behalf of the City of Vancouver in my capacity as Deputy Mayor, which started at 12:01 on April Fool's Day, a.m. On behalf of Mayor Gregor Robertson. Gregor really wanted to be here and was so blessed to have an hour and a half with Majora today to walk around the neighborhood. But I know he really wanted to see all of you too. Of course, many of you who know me or heard my bio just now probably know that I would be here anyway. I have spent, whether or not I'm a city councilor or deputy mayor or any of those other things, I have spent the better part of, my entire adult life trying to make positive environmental changes for people and communities. And Majora, she really exemplifies what happens when people and communities come together around environmental change. It's such an understatement to say that, you know. I'm totally in awe of you, Majora, so thank you for being here. So one thing that wasn't in my bio and that you might not know about me, because I try not to advertise it too much, but it seemed relevant to talk about a bit tonight, is that environmental activism wasn't actually my first call to action in life. To hear my mom tell it, it actually started sometime around preschool. There was a raisin incident, apparently. The quality of them was not good, which I remember well, but I don't remember organizing, apparently, a very successful sit-in to get rid of the bad raisins. But what we could agree on is that I had a very keen sense of fairness as a child and a strong, let's call it a compulsion to question authority. And for a variety of reasons, not just that, I left home at 13. So you can imagine, if you think life is unfair and unjust when you're at home, what it's like when you're living, sleeping on concrete or eating out of dumpsters or seeing people who are even worse off than you are in that situation. So the first and most foundational lesson that I learned in that 6 years living on the street is that I think it's true for any of us, I've learned that since then, but especially if you live outside of the power structure, you will get absolutely nowhere, you won't get anything, and you're not going to go anywhere unless you work with other people. That is the first and most basic lesson. Well, apparently we learn this in kindergarten, but not all of us do, clearly, because we're not doing it all the time. So I started to organize. I lobbied for housing, I lobbied for education, we sat in for food banks, we lobbied for multi-ride transit tickets. That took me, one of the things people don't know about living on the street is it's actually much cheaper to keep moving. You just put a backpack on and stick your thumb out and you don't build up debts or obligations. And in a very cathartic moment, I was in Central America with some housing activists. I'm not gonna get into the full details, but suffice it to say that it became really clear in this moment of building housing in a low-income community that wealth, that no matter how much housing we build in the world, clean environment is what ultimately matters. That you can be, wealth begins when you walk out of your front door, not when you walk in it. And if the air and the water outside is not healthy for people, then it doesn't really matter what we're doing on the social side of things. So I came back to Canada because I believe we are a major exporter of environmental problems. At that time, I was probably somewhat fortuitously lucky to be living on the street in the time in our history as a country when our wealth and compassion were at their closest point. They weren't close, but they were close enough that job training programs existed everywhere. I literally walked out of a hitchhike drive at Main and Hastings, went into the Carnegie Center, and within the next day was in a job training program that ultimately led to my green job. We didn't call them that at the time. But that was the Wilderness Committee. I started there when I was 19 years old, and I've been there ever since. But the most essential part of the story, and I'm sorry it had to be such a big backstory, the second day that I worked at the Wilderness Committee, I was volunteering. Paul George, who some of you may know, he's a really big guy with a beard and stuff, white beard. I had purple mohawk and, you know, maybe didn't inspire sort of trust and respect necessarily. And he handed me this bag and he said, could you take this to the bank? And, you know, I kind of think this is a joke of some sort. I said, sure, I'll take it to the bank. What's in it? And he said, oh, $10,000 in cash. Be careful on the train. And, you know, in that moment, you can't believe what this is like when you've been totally absent to most of the world. Like, you don't even really, you're just invisible as far as that goes. To not just have something that you believe in so strongly as I did in the environment, but to actually have someone believe in you for a change. Like, that's the moment that changes people's lives, and obviously changed mine. So there's no question that we face huge environmental problems. I'm not going to get into that because I'm looking around the room knowing most of you give talks publicly about these things. There's no question that our old economy is part of the problem. Some of you may not know that the port here, the number one shipment out of our port is metallurgical coal. It is shipped to China on these large ships that you see that burn basically bunker fuel, which creates more weight. If it was burning, they burn about $100,000 a day in bunker fuel. If they were burning gas, like the kind you have in your car, it'd be $1 million a day. That's how many greenhouse gases are being caused. So that goes to China to make steel. The steel then gets shipped to Japan on another ship, and then, just to complete the loop, it all comes back here in the form of a car that was manufactured in Japan. That is not what the new economy is going to look like here in the downtown east side or near the port. And that's why the one question we have left is how we're going to take the challenges we have and turn them into opportunities, but most specifically, opportunities for the people who don't see opportunity in the current economy. So the approach Majora is taking, and now the Strathcona Business Improvement Association is contemplating, is so very powerful. First, you need a mission, and then you need to invite people in and trust that with that mission there, that they will be the very best people that they could be. If we can do that, and I know Sustainability 2.0 is the call to action, the mission that the Strathcona BIA is setting out for this community, and then if you can invite people in and trust that they will be the very best people that they can be in achieving that mission, we will turn this from ground zero, this neighborhood, for ground zero about stories about despair, into ground zero for stories about hope and achievement and prosperity. And that is why I'm so very thankful to Majora for being someone who's inspiring that vision, and to the Strathcona BIA for being someone who's actualizing it, and to all of you for bearing witness to that and adding your voices to whatever piece of that that you can add. So thank you, everyone.
Andrea, and thanks to everyone for coming down here today and for staying through all of this in this cold area. We forgot to tell you that we were actually trying to save on our GHG emissions, so that's why it's a little bit cold. But, you know, this event was a result of a lot of people's time and passion, and a lot of this was done really just on volunteer time. So I want to thank, you know, the people that really made that possible, the volunteers on the Sustainability Committee that have really put their time and lives into bringing this all together. We do a lot without money, but we also do need money at some point to make things happen. So we thank our sponsors as well, Van City, definitely for their support, Bob as well, BC Hydro, the Vancouver Economic Development Commission of Vancouver Agreement and the City of Vancouver. Thank you all for your support and for allowing us to make this happen. So just kind of before we wind it up, I just you know, I'll cut this pretty short, but I just kind of want to share an experience of my own just over the past little while that I think is kind of relevant here today. But, you know, the past 6 months have been a crazy change, I think, in the world as far as the economy goes. And I think in some ways we've kind of gone into this tailspin. And as a business owner, that's been a real challenge in terms of how do we survive and how do we reinvent and evolve. And so these things were really getting onto my mind. You know, how are we going to survive, and how is our staff going to react, and how do we keep things going? And about 3 weeks ago, I actually hit a point where I was as paralyzed, really, by all this kind of pressure that was going on and the uncertainty of things. And you know, I couldn't make any decisions, and I felt like I'd been on a tightrope. And you know, I'd suddenly look down, and I was frozen. And so I started to realize how are we going to get through this? And you know, we can't go back. You know, the option of failure, falling off, is not something we wanted to do either. So we really just focused on what do we need to do and what do we want to be, and we started taking steps, and we really moved through that. And I think as a society, we're in a similar place. We're in this uncertainty. You know, we don't know. We've got massive issues of climate change, of the environment, of, you know, how we care for one another and the planet. And I think we're in the same place. We can't go back. You know, the option for failure is pretty severe. And so we need to take those steps to move, you know, into the community that we want. And I think what happened here today was all of us taking a step together confidently in that new direction. And there'll be more steps to follow that. But I think, you know, the beauty of it is there's a role for all of us to play, and it's all about building community. So thanks everyone for coming out today.